This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Yo, what is going down, everybody? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecracks Movie Podcast.
Show me the Westerns for the third week in a row.
Oh, that's it. That's it. Is this a Western, though? I mean, famously, somebody just came out and was digging in this, saying that this isn't a Western.
Oh, so God, now we gotta, you're getting right into it,
I'm
huh?
getting straight into it. Straight into the controversy. What's up, everybody? I'm Austin Hayden, and I'm joined by the Show Me the Meaning bro, not crew today, but bro, Raymond. What's up, dude?
Yeah, we are entering the drift once again. A little two-man podcast here.
That's it. That's it. And honestly, I mean, I feel like we could tackle Westerns all the time because so much of contemporary, especially American, but definitely Western cinema is Western adjacent, right? So we could say that we are talking about a theme that we've talked about a thousand times, but I think there's something really fresh with talking about this film, The Power of the Dog, directed by Jane Campion. It just came out. It's getting nominated for all kinds of awards. It stars Benedict Cumberbatch, Kirsten Dunst, Jesse Plemons, Cody Smith McPhee. It's got a lot of attention, and most recently it stirred up a little bit of controversy, which was my illusion at the very beginning, with Sam Elliott basically coming out and ripping this film.
I don't think the movie stirred up controversy. I think that an old man said something dumb or whatever.
Well, here's the thing. So I saw this at the Sydney Film Festival, and what people were talking about was the ideas that it brought up. So maybe not that it stirs up controversy, but it pokes the bear a little bit. It provokes some kind of dormant, long-held, presumed ideas about masculinity, about the West, about America, all kinds of different things. And so in that sense, I mean, I think it is a provocative film.
In a way, but I also think there's, you know, it's kind of tough to escape comparisons to Brokeback Mountain as another movie about gay cowboys. But I think that it is, we're a long way from that film, because I just remember the constant drum about that movie, about it being like a disgrace, and it's a disgrace to the genre, the great, you know, genre of Westerns, and how dare they depict cowboys as gay, etc., etc. Just, there was so much hand-wringing about that back then, and I just feel like this movie, until the Sam Elliott thing, I don't feel like this one has felt as provocative as that, you know, 15 years on. Not that that should have been seen as provocative, Brokeback Mountain. You know, it's a wonderful film, and obviously that kind of discourse was being led by the loudest, dumbest voices in the room. But I do think that this one is, maybe just because it hasn't had the same kind of, like, theatrical phenomenon kind of effect that Brokeback Mountain did, which was like a really big surprise hit when it came out. But it just, you know, that is one small thing I can point to as a silver lining, is that, like, the Sam Elliott thing is the first I've heard of anyone really, you know, lodging a complaint or being all ignorant surrounding this.
So I guess then let's do this. I mean, normally we go around and we'll do first impressions. So let's just jump right into it. But actually, real quick before we do, I just want to do some housekeeping stuff. Make sure you follow us on Twitter at SMTM_POD. That's SMTM_POD. You can also email us at movies@wisecrack.co, movies@wisecrack.co. You can call us at 1-213-534-8807, and you can leave us a voicemail. We're going to be doing a mailbag session here, or a mailbag episode in the next few weeks. So get us your thoughts, ideas, fan theories. What do you think about this film? What do you think about stuff from our back catalog? And check out Culture Binge, other Wisecrack stuff. But yeah, so let's jump in and let's talk about first impressions. I mean, I don't know how many times you've seen this film, but I guess, yeah. So how did it land?
Yeah, I mean, I watched it a couple months ago whenever it landed on Netflix there. And I thought it was fine. I didn't think it was really anything special. I think the performances are good. I think it's well directed. I think the big thing that kind of keeps this movie at arm's length for me, at least, is that I just think that Jane Campion, while a wonderful filmmaker, is just maybe not a good fit for this material. And you, I'm curious how viciously you'll disagree with me on this, but I think that this, I haven't read the book, but having watched the movie, this feels like it could really benefit from like just a touch of griminess. You know, I would have really liked to see, like, you know, Jennifer Kent's take on this, or someone like Lynn Ramsey in You Were Never Really Here mode with with Joaquin yeah. Phoenix in the Benedict Cumberbatch role. I wish there was someone behind the camera with this. Not that Jane Campion doesn't do a fine job, but I wish it was just a little more claustrophobic, a little more tense, a little bit more insular. As it is, I think it's a perfectly fine picture. Like I said, the performances especially, I think, are solid all around. But it just kind of leaves me wanting more. It doesn't really stick with me all that much after I'm finished with it. But I don't know. How do you feel?
Honestly, the exact same. I was actually, I was talking about this with Matt, our producer, before we started recording, that I really
great producer. We love Matt.
Great. The best producer in podcasting, tied only with Maddie, who also produces Owls at Dawn now. So, you know, the best two producers in the game. But honestly, we were talking about how we both really went in wanting to kind of love this movie. You know, I told you, I think previously off air, that I saw this at the Sydney Film Fest.
You mentioned it three times on the podcast. You mentioned it once last week and twice this week now. Folks, he wants you to know he's a big time Hollywood big shot.
This was the first time, not the first film, this was the first time that I had gone out of my house to do something social after the pandemic.
You had all these expectations you were really building in.
And we're fucking masked up in the theater. It's hot and claustrophobic and sweaty. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because I wouldn't say I loved the film, but I did find a lot of stuff really intriguing to dissect. And so you just said something that's really interesting about how you thought maybe if like Lynn Ramsey directed it and someone like Joaquin Phoenix were in the Benedict Cumberbatch role. At first, my instinct to that was maybe, because my initial issue was that I didn't love Benedict Cumberbatch in this. There was something, I didn't believe it or whatever. But then upon reflection, I think I get the choice, because the choice of this character is not a grimy, dirty, embodied. I think Joaquin is a little bit too earthen, and Benedict Cumberbatch is quite a bit more cerebral. And I think the tension there of a man, the character that Benedict Cumberbatch is playing, Phil, who is a cerebral, educated, Ivy League educated man who also has repressed sexual desire, but is playing the role of the kind of stereotype of what it means to be a man in this time period.
Sort of swaggery and...
Yeah, and it felt forced to me, and I think it kind of fits with some of the tensions that the film is exploring.
You
know,
one of those tricky performances of, like,
too good.
Playing a person who's playing an idea of a person, in a way. You know, there's a certain nuance to it. I think Benedict Cumberbatch is good in the film, but I think my head went to Joaquin Phoenix just because, like, not necessarily that I want that character to be grimier, but just the movie itself. Just this is a very pulpy sort of text. You know, this is a movie that, you know, spoiler alert, ends with a kid revenge killing someone with an anthrax laced lasso, like, which is it's very Harlequin novel-y. Like, there's something very lurid about that.
It is.
I haven't read the book. I would like to. I've heard it's very good. So I'm curious how it scans on the page, because I can see this working better on the page in a way, just because that's a little bit more insular of a medium. But I don't know. Sorry for cutting you off.
No, that's perfect. Yeah. I mean, so I guess my summation of my first impression was that I think I was hoping that it would hit me a little bit more. I just saw Jane Campion, Western. Love Jane Campion as a filmmaker. Yeah. Westerns are my jam. I think I just was hoping that it would be revelatory.
VIP, right? At Sydney Film Fest. You saw, of course, you know.
Hey,
you can't
did
resist.
I saw this at Sydney Film Fest, and okay, so before we start unpacking this, let's go into a quick rundown of the plot, okay? So it's 1925 in Montana. There's a wealthy ranch-owning pair of brothers named Phil and George, and they meet a widow who also owns an inn by the name of Rose during one of their cattle drives. The kind-hearted George is quickly taken with Rose, while the volatile Phil is kind of influenced by this mentor figure named Bronco Henry, and he is not so kind, and he ends up mocking Rose's son named Peter because he has a lisp and a bit of an effeminate manner. So George and Rose end up getting married, and she moves into the ranch house and is able to use George's money to send Peter to college to study medicine and surgery. Phil takes an immediate dislike to Rose, believing that she's only married George for their money. Phil's rough ways and taunting manner ultimately unnerve her, and one evening, George organizes a dinner party with his parents and the governor, and George intends to introduce his guests to Rose so that they can meet Rose and hear her play the new piano, which is an instrument that she kind of is like, I don't really play that well anyway, but they kind of coax her into it. During the party, though, Rose is rattled by Phil's earlier belittling of her skills, and she's unable to play more than a few notes. And she gets further humiliated when Phil mocks her about her practicing, so she kind of dives deeper into drinking alcohol, which is something that she previously was opposed to. Now, by the time Peter comes to stay at the ranch for the summer break, Rose has become a full-on alcoholic. Phil and his men taunt Peter, and he basically locks himself in his room. He brings home a rabbit that he's caught, and that kind of delights his mom, but then she finds out that Peter has killed it and dissected it. And so in later in a secluded clearing, Phil masturbates. I mean, is it clear that he masturbates, or is it implied that he masturbates with Bronco Henry's scarf? And Peter enters the clearing and he finds a stash of magazines with Bronco Henry's name on them depicting nude men. And he observes Phil bathing in a pond with the handkerchief around his neck. Phil notices him and chases him off. Now, Phil begins to kind of start to show decency to Peter. He offers to plait him a lasso from rawhide and teach him how to ride a horse. And so Peter kind of goes along with it. Peter heads out on his own one day, and he finds a dead cow from which he cuts off pieces of its hide. And while working on a fencing job, Phil injures his hand clearing the wood. Now, afterward, Peter tells Phil about finding the body of his alcoholic father, who had hanged himself and cut the corpse down by himself. And he mentions that his father told him that he was not kind enough, and Phil kind of scoffs. Rose's alcoholism gets worse and worse and worse, and especially because she sees how much time her son's spending with Phil. And so after she learns about Phil's policy of burning the hides that he doesn't need for himself, she defiantly gives the hides to a local Native American trader who thanks her with a pair of gloves. She then collapses with her radical alcohol consumption, and George tends to her, throwing out the bottle of bourbon that she's been hiding. Phil is enraged over not having any of the hides that he needs to finish Peter's lasso, and he attempts to lash out at Rose before being stopped by George. Now, Peter calms Phil down by offering him the hide that he had cut from that dead cow, but without mentioning that the animal was already deceased when he encountered it. Phil is touched by Peter's gesture and promises him that they will have a much better relationship in the future. The pair spend the night in the barn finishing the rope, and Phil's open wound and the hide mixing together in the solution used to soften the hide. Now, as the two share a cigarette, Phil tells Peter about how Bronco Henry saved his life one time by lying body to body with him in a bedroll during freezing weather. But Phil doesn't answer when Peter asks if they were naked. When Phil does not show up for breakfast the following day, George finds him sickened in bed with his wound now really infected. And so a delirious Phil looks for Peter to give him the finished lasso, but George takes Phil away to the doctor before Phil can hand the lasso over. George is then later seen picking out a coffin for his brother who has died. Now, at the funeral, the doctor tells George that Phil most likely died from anthrax, but that puzzles George because Phil was always very careful to avoid diseased cattle. Peter, who skipped Phil's funeral, opens a book of common prayer to a passage on burial rites and then reads Psalm 22:20 that says, "Deliver my soul from the sword, my darling from the power of the dog." Later, he puts his finished lasso under his bed with gloved hands. And as Peter walks down the hall, he stops at a window and watches George and a now sober Rose return home and embrace, and he turns away and smiles. Dun dun dun! But before we continue, I got to give a quick interjection. We got to shout out our sponsor, Skillshare. Skillshare is an online learning community where you can connect with other like-minded people and creatives, and where you can explore projects that you are passionate about. And this is why Skillshare is really so cool, because you can do all of this and you can unleash your creativity and you can pursue your passions, but right from the convenience of your own home. They offer thousands of classes for creative and curious people on topics such as iPhone photography, drone filming, editing, classes for improving productivity, artivism, which is, you know, like the intersection of art and activism, and a lot of stuff that I've been doing recently, which is on like digital design, UX, UI, the ethics of design. They do some really cool stuff. So go check out all that they've got to offer, and you can explore your creativity and connect with some cool people in the process by going to skillshare.com/smtm. That's skillshare.com/smtm. And the cool thing is if you are a listener, you're going to get a free trial of their premium membership. So if you want to get a free trial of their premium membership, go to skillshare.com/smtm or click the link below. All right. So let's get into this here. You did mention that the plot is a little bit pulpy. So the insinuations does one, like, so it's pretty clear, like, he kills Phil. Peter kills Phil. So he kills him by poisoning him with anthrax from this diseased cow. The question is, why does he do it? And the reason I want to start here is because I think that this kind of touches on pretty much all of the themes that this film is exploring. So, one, why he did it. Did he do it to help his mother in an act of revenge? Sure. Did he do it to kind of put Phil out of his misery as a man who no longer belongs in the world and who is dealing with this repression? Possibly.
I would say almost certainly not.
No? You don't think so? And I then, okay, so, and then. And then a possible third option is, did he do it in an act of his own repression, that he has to kill Phil so that he doesn't have a similar mentor relationship like Phil had with Bronco Henry, because he was a person, a young person disjointed in a world. So those are kind of three different things that, like, I wonder, right? And I think some of them contradict, because also the question is he himself, like, are we to think that he himself is gay, and or is it not? It's just that he's portrayed in the part of, like, the stereotype of not being man enough, and therefore Phil kind of lashes out at him because of that. But anyway, like, these are kind of some of the questions that are coming up in my mind. So what do we think?
Well, I think that some of our listeners may get mad at me for being, like, somewhat reductive, but I just thought it was because Benedict Cumberbatch is an asshole. Like, it was, and I mean, I say that, and obviously there's layers to that, but I didn't come away from this movie thinking, like, wow, where did that come from? Why on earth would this kid that Benedict Cumberbatch spent the first hour of the movie completely terrorizing, why on earth could he possibly have wanted to kill this guy? Like, he has a very sort of cavalier and clinical relationship with death, as illustrated by the scene with the rabbit in his room. You know, this is someone who is, like, he's capable of taking a life. Is that, you know, is that the same as a human life? For some folks, probably not. But it doesn't really seem like that much of a stretch to me. I'm not left scratching my head like, oh, what were his motives? Honest to God, I came away from it like, oh yeah, he just Benedict Cumberbatch was a really toxic and dangerous presence for both him and his mother and basically everyone that he comes into contact with, and he found a really easy way to kill him. And it just, and it's one of those things where, like, I don't necessarily know how premeditated it was. I think that it is intentional, but I don't think he spends the entire movie plotting out, like, oh wow, it's sort of a crime of opportunity, you know. Is it his hand got ripped open? I have access to this diseased cowhide. He happens to be in a situation where he wants some cowhide, and I can I can just knock him off and it'll be this easy. And I don't even have to get my hands dirty, really. And it is one of those things, I think, to the extent that it is an interesting or subtle decision on his part, is just that question of, like, I'm sure that there's a philosophical framework for this, Austin, that notion of, like, oh, I don't know, if you could go back in time and kill baby Hitler, would you? And and I think a lot of it boils down to, like, or the trolley problem thing, like, how many weird hypothetical conversations have started with that notion of, like, would you be capable of killing a truly evil person? And under what circumstances? Like, would I have to brain them with a cudgel, or could I just press a button, you know, like in the Richard Matheson story, and someone somewhere, someone that I don't know, will die? And that, to me, is maybe the extent to which it's really interesting when it comes to his motivations. Is just, like, I don't know, did this kid really consider what it means to take a human life, or is this something that he just has a clinical distance from and won't really reckon with the actual sort of emotional consequences of that until maybe after the film has rolled credits?
Yeah, that's why I think it's interesting that maybe there are layers to this, right? So, I mean, at one, the immediate is, sure, Phil sucked. Like, he's abusive, he's denigrating, he even gets all of the fucking other ranch hands to come in and pile on. He's just a fucking bad dude. And then on top of that, he berates Rose, and so Peter is witness to how this is affecting his mother. It's plunging her into alcoholism, which is something that she's been against. And why? Why? Because Phil can't come to grips with some repressed desires. Phil can't accept his own identity or his own stirrings or things about himself as an educated man who's also a wealthy man and who wants to be a ranch man. So there are these kind of different identities that he's moving through, like these different narrative positions that he's moving through. And so that's why I also wonder then, so at the surface level, it's clearly revenge, but then is there also a sense in which it's kind of a mercy killing? It's kind of putting this guy out of his misery, right? Like, Phil can't accept who he is. And you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me again of stuff that we've talked about a bit in the last couple of weeks. We talked about it with Michael last week. We were talking about The Ballad of Cable Hogue, which is a story about a person who is historically disjointed, a man who belonged in a previous time, right? And I think you get something similar here with Phil, is that Phil can't deal with the fact of being disjointed by these larger processes of historical development, of, you know, kind of like shifting identities, technological development, familial development. George brings in somebody else and starts a new family, and that kind of like seems to threaten Phil, not just because of money, but also because of, like, the dynamic and power of the household and his hold over George too, right? Like, his hold, because George is more of a passive soul. He's a man disjointed, and so there's a sense in which it's kind of like a mercy killing. And then I wonder what this means for, like, Peter's own inner life himself. Like, are we meant to think that he too has desires that he's able to tap into and that he's able to access and express? And that's part of the reason that Phil doesn't like it, because it comes out as, you know, being interested in flowers and design and things like that. I guess the question is then, is, are we meant to surmise that those are, like, expressions of homosexual desire, or is that even too kind of abstract and reductive? And that there's another sense in which, you know, the Peter character is kind of more robust in who he is, and that maybe he's even struggling with that. And so he has to knock this guy off, because he doesn't want to get stuck in that same kind of pattern, potentially, you know, like because then I'm kind of thinking this Bronco Henry relationship with Phil was probably a bad power dynamic, you know? It probably wasn't like a healthy, like, they were just good friends. It was probably tumultuous at times, even though in retrospect, Phil looks with like high regard to it, as you often do with like a father figure, you know, even though you ignore the trauma that's there. So that's, I'm kind of wondering if there's those layers.
I mean, I think it may be reasonable to assume that regarding Phil's past or his relationship with Bronco Henry. As far as the, just to double back to the mercy killing thing, I think the reason that's difficult for me to latch on to is that maybe that's something that's animating him on a subconscious level, or who knows? I mean, Cody Smith McPhee could give an interview tomorrow and say that that's how he interpreted it. As far as my interpretation of it is concerned, I don't really perceive... While Benedict Cumberbatch is a violent, repressive asshole, for me, a mercy killing is something that sort of, it connotes a sense of like self-destruction, that like, oh, I'm going to, you know, drown this person to save them from the rain. Like this, I don't really, while he has like emotionally self-destructive tendencies, and while, you know, he represses his inner feelings and lashes out at people and has a tough time, you know, just dealing with that sort of thing, and it may manifest in really really toxic and abusive ways, I don't think the movie is sending that signal that this is someone who like needs to be saved from themselves so much as they are like a local antagonist. They may be nuanced and layered, and there may be reasons for that antagonism, but I don't think the movie ever characterizes him in such a fashion that would lend itself to that interpretation. Once again, that's just my interpretation. As far as some of the other stuff you were touching on, I do think that maybe there's a bit more meat on the bone with regards to the sort of displacement of the center of power within this family. That as Jesse Plemons, you know, becomes beholden to Kirsten Dunst and her son, and he feels this sense of familial obligation towards them, it does throw off the power dynamic, and it does threaten Benedict Cumberbatch's supremacy within that domestic sphere. That, you know, Jesse Plemons is no longer just a yes man who's going to defer to him to protect his feelings. You know, it's one of those things where, like, he has other people to consider now, and I can definitely see how that is... I mean, that's not even a stretch on our end. Like that, I think that's very much baked into the relationship dynamics in this movie. So I guess this is the thing that I guess I sort of just need to come out and say, is that I don't think this movie has a whole lot that it leaves up to interpretation. I think we can sit here and kind of, you know, offer conjecture when it comes to, or as it pertains to their internal lives and their thought processes and stuff. But, you know, for example, Kirsten Dunst, her journey from teetotaler to alcoholic is like, very much just, it just happens, and it just happens right in front of you, and they telegraph it. They go, oh, I never touch a drop of the stuff. And then she has this really great scene where she has this emotional sort of nervous breakdown at the piano, and then she turns to drink, and that's where like the glass is broken. And you kind of just know that that can really only proceed in one direction, and it does.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of stuff with this. Once again, that's not to denigrate the film or anything. I just don't think it's a terribly unsubtle film, other than we can kind of cavil about the real underlying shades of their motivation and such. But at the end of the day, like I said, I think the kid killed him because he's an asshole. Like, it just...
Yeah, I'm glad you're bringing this up, because I think I'm starting to have more self-awareness about like why things resonate.
Benedict Cumberbatch is an asshole, not Cody Smith McPhee, but sorry, go
on. Yeah. No, I know what you mean. And we've talked about this, and I think you pointed this out maybe a month and a half, 2 months back, about like why certain films resonate with me, and it is that there's a poetry that I'm attracted to. And one of my acting teachers once had said that, you know, like all that matters when you're doing performance that you maintain the what's going to happen next in the mind of the audience. As soon as the audience stops being invested in what's going to happen next, then that you've lost them, right? And I think one of my frustrations with a lot of media and a lot of cinema that gets made today is there's not a lot of deep and really robust what's going to happen next. A lot of it is spoon-fed. We might think, oh, what's going to happen next? But then it comes and we're kind of like, oh yeah, I mean, that was already, it was already baked in. It was already there. It was already a possible. And the philosopher Omri Bergson talks about the problem with the possible is that the possible is already kind of present in the present, right? It just has a level of reality that's added to it. So it's not really new, right? Whereas when you think about the possibilities of the virtual, I mean, maybe even saying the possibilities of the virtual is using words that I shouldn't use, but he talks about the virtual, or the philosopher Gilles Deleuze takes this. Deleuze wrote two books on cinema for people who are interested, called The Time Image and The Movement Image. But this idea that there's an unknown that is more novel and new than possibility. So if I think about possible options for where this film was going to go, it's pretty much baked in from moment to moment, right? There's nothing truly revelatory. There's nothing truly kind of, oh shit. There's nothing truly that makes you ponder and think, wow, how does this transform my world? Unless you do some heavy lifting and you start kind of like looking at some things like you're talking about, like really delving into the psyches and shit like that, which is, I'm fine to speculate on, because to me, I think that's fun.
I think that's kind of the province of this podcast a lot of the time. Yeah.
But I think you're right. And I think part of the reason maybe why I didn't love my viewing experience of
despite this, it being at the Sydney Film Festival.
Which, by the way, which was at the Sydney Film Festival. I think part of the reason was because it was slow, but it didn't intrigue me enough and like call me to like new heights of thought. Whereas like a Tarkovsky film is slow, but I'm always like, what just happened and where are they going to go with this? And what are these ideas and what's the content, you know? And I didn't quite have that because I was just constantly fed conveniently these really kind of more simple payoffs. And I think maybe that was kind of part of the problem of the formula of the film.
If Ryan were here right now, he would probably say like, but you guys love the writer, you know, or something. He might call that up and say like, what makes that movie work for you as opposed to a movie like this that in your words is either slow or ponderous in a way that doesn't really feel rewarding. And I think the reason, or one of the many reasons that the writer works for me, is that in those more quiet and ruminative moments, they're making you lean in, and they're not laying out a clear emotional or mental path for Brady. Like he's just a naturally stoic person played by a naturally stoic person, and there is a sense of like, you know, to come back to the question of self-destruction, there is that knot at the center of the writer is like, what compels him to continue doing this deeply self-destructive thing and this thing that he can't let go of that he loves so deeply. And I think there is just something naturally compelling about that in a way that this movie has plenty of beautiful, quiet, ruminative moments or moments that are coded as such.
Would be, yeah.
It's not really precipitating any big reveal. It's not hinting at any like otherwise concealed character aspects. It's not lending itself to a sense of mystery and intrigue, as you said. It really just kind of feels like, and this comes back to my core criticism of the film, it feels like Jane Campion wanting to show some really beautiful kind of Jane Campion-esque shots. And and that's the thing, is like, I think she's a wonderful filmmaker, but I just don't think she's the right fit for this, for that reason, that I think this movie could really thrive on that tension, the sort of like the thickness of the quiet moments that you want to be able to cut with a knife, but instead it's like we keep cutting outside and deflating that. There is no sense of like claustrophobia, and it doesn't really feel like these characters are trapped, which is maybe one of the reasons I reject your notion of this being a mercy killing, because a mercy killing feels like the sort of eventual end game of a character that has boxed themselves in. And so that's one of the things for me with this is that, like, once again, I haven't read the book. I'm curious how it feels, how it reads, because when I watch this, I think that's the big thing that's missing for me is it never feels like these characters are on the pathway towards totality or inevitability. It doesn't feel like tragedy. It kind of is sort of like structured like one without any real sense of inevitability baked into the cake or dread or however you want to define it.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yeah, I wonder too, like, when Peter kind of, so he kills Phil, and he turns and he kind of smiles at the end, and we kind of get that callback to how he, like, killed a rabbit. Like, were we meant to be like, oh, the dude's a serial killer? Like, that's kind of like the pulpy interpretation, right? The pulpy interpretation is like, oh, this motherfucker's going to be a serial killer. Like, you know, like...
I think there is kind of a... I'm trying to think of another example of this in media because I'm sure that one will pop into my head as soon as we stop recording. But I do like the notion of Phil projecting this sense. That's Benedict Cumberbatch, right, Phil?
Yeah.
He projects this sense, like you said, of the masculine ideal, the sort of romanticized version, the Marlboro Man, you know. So he projects that even though he's maybe not comfortable in his own skin, and there's some shades of nuance to that performance. And someone who is so like, it may be slightly outside of his element, but he understands the role that he has to play and how he fits within this power dynamic or this narrative dynamic, being completely blindsided by someone who does not play by the rules of the Old West, who does not believe in the romance of the Old West, who fucking hates it out here and is just like, no, I won't beat you in a duel. I'll just kill you when you're asleep. Like, there is something cool about that in a way, that notion of like, well, yeah, I mean, if he played Phil in Pirates of the Caribbean, there's that great line where he goes, in a fair fight, I would have beaten you easily. And Jack Sparrow goes, well, that's not much incentive for me to fight fairly. And Phil is someone who's like, you know, you may not like it, but there's a code. There's a romance to the West. Like, men are men, and men look each other in the eye when they shoot at each other. And Cody Smith-Murphy's like, actually, fuck you. I'm just going to poison you. And, like, you're utterly unprepared for that person showing up within this romantic paradigm. So I do think there's something interesting there, but it's only kind of, like, you only see glimpses of it. You none of that ever gets, like, pulled out in a way other than, like I said, there is that kind of interesting clinical remove that he has from the rabbit when he's dissecting it. But you never get the sort of like Dexter in the West or whatever sort of thing you may be hinting at or implying.
Yeah. What is it, do you think, this is another kind of thing that I didn't understand, like the turn. Why does Phil decide to take Peter under his wing? Like, what was the catalyst there? Was it just because he saw an act of graciousness from Peter? And so then he's like, okay, well, now I can take him under my wing? Or is it that he sees that maybe in the same way that Bronco Henry, maybe, I don't know. I'm just totally speculating here. But maybe there was like a predatory, like grooming relationship with Phil. And so.
Yeah, it may be ungenerous, but that's kind of how I interpreted it, that Phil was essentially kind of like, oh, I now have this sort of glimpse of a like-minded person, and I may be able to, I may be able to sort of reclaim the power in this relationship through that, and you know, and by appealing to his own repressed desires. And that's how I interpreted it. But once again, that's probably the easiest read of the film. But also, once again, I don't really know if this movie is often demanding that we give it anything other than the easiest, most objective kind of read of it. My big takeaway from it was even not necessarily that, like, it has to be steeped in the notions of, like, grooming or predatory behavior, but whatever ambiguity there is regarding Phil and Henry's relationship, I think it amounts to that question of, like, well, are they gay, or was this just a sense of companionship, a sense of longing? You know, that's one of the beautiful things about Brokeback Mountain is like how that starts as just, it almost feels like just two guys who are lonely and see something in the other person that they understand them, they understand where they come from, and it just kind of naturally evolves in a really beautiful and intimate way. And then they discover it, almost like they discover their sexual orientation through each other rather than like living with this repressed sense of sexuality yeah. their entire lives. So I think there could be some of that in this. I mean, I dare say there absolutely is some of that in this, but I definitely read it as him having kind of the intent to groom him, or at least seek some kind of companionship, or at the very least someone that he can be honest with and open with and not have to play this character.
It's interesting. I just recently read something from someone who was like a colleague of mine from back in the day, but there's this scholar that used to be a scholar of like psychology and philosophy and has transitioned and is now like a trans author. And I think she works in like fucking design or something like that. But anyway, did a PhD or ABD at least in like philosophy and psychology. And she wrote a book called Transgressive. Her name's Rachel Williams. And she was talking about the difference between like the Acorn theory of like emergent desire or emergent identity versus what she calls like the butterfly and caterpillar form. And I thought it was really interesting because it's kind of stuck with me. And she says, like, you know, I refer to kind of my transition in terms of choice, but a lot of times people don't like to think that because they like to think, you know, it's like I was born this way and it was something that was always repressed and always there. And she said that's more like the acorn theory, right? Like Aristotle famously talks about like this idea of teleology, that like in the acorn, the oak tree is there, right? Like, and it's just in a germinal form.
It's just in a latent state. Rachel is,
exactly, yeah. Rachel, though, likes to talk about like the butterfly idea, that like you have to actually die before you can emerge as a butterfly. So the caterpillar, when it goes through its stage and its cocoon, its chrysalis, whatever it's called, when it goes through that stage, it literally fucking gets dissolved and dies and then is like recombined in a new way and then is a butterfly. And it's only after the fact that retroactively it can look back and be like, oh, okay, so there was something there. But it was a very different experience than like the acorn one, right? And, you know, Rachel's obviously not trying to denigrate either experience, but I think there's something interesting here that you kind of maybe get that as well in this film that, there's
it,
like just, a...
Imagine that. Someone put it far better than I possibly could have. But I think that's really beautifully stated, and I do think that's illustrative of how like I was saying about Brokeback Mountain, how certain relationships are depicted on screen and certain orientations or awakenings happen within the context of a narrative, and how that stuff kind of unfolds. I think that's really beautiful. I'll have to look up some of her work.
Yeah, it stuck with me. Here's the thing. We've been talking a lot about Phil and Peter, but we haven't talked a lot about George and Rose. So what do we think about that dynamic? Like, I love Jesse Plemons as an actor. I think he's fantastic. Yes. I love Kirsten Dunst. Some of my favorite films actually have her in them, like Melancholia being one of them. I think she's tremendous.
One of my all-time favorites.
So
real quick before we get to the characters, just I want to second your Jesse Plemons love. I think genuinely one of his generation's finest actors. I think he's phenomenal. Go on.
My partner, when we were watching this, after we left the Sydney Film Fest, she turned to me and she...
You can't do it when I'm drinking.
she said, she was like, I love Jesse Plemons and I love Kirsten Dunst, but I didn't necessarily love the kind of like typical manic woman who falls into alcoholism trope thing, right? So... I wonder, like, was there enough buildup to make her transition, like, like organic, or did it seem a bit tropey? Did it seem a bit kind of like someone was pulling at caricatures and then kind of created a character that wasn't as robust maybe as it could have been otherwise?
I think, like I said before, I think it seems a little bit telegraphed, but I think she's so good in the movie. I can see where your partner's coming from, that maybe it feels a little bit cliched or archetypal or however you want to qualify it. But I think she sells it. I think it's well acted. Like I said, though, it just doesn't really leave a whole lot up to the imagination. It doesn't ask a whole lot of the audience. And I also think, though, that the movie maybe wouldn't gain all that much by us like having to put those pieces together. So more than anything, I agree with your partner insofar as, like, you know, sometimes movies just don't give certain characters a whole lot to do. But I also think you could maybe say the same about a lot of the characters in this film. I know this is a pretty short book. And I do kind of wonder, a lot of it is, like I've been saying, it's all kind of A to B to C. And there are wonderful scenes and sequences within that, but it just, you know, it all just kind of happens and that's that. And I think that, yes, on the one hand, I could see how maybe she's not given a whole lot to do in this film other than kind of like, you know, sit around and glower nervously and eventually take to drink. But there's also, I mean, Jesse Plemons, who I think is also great in the movie, he's also not given a whole lot to do other than kind of sit around and glower and then, like,
yeah, that's how I felt.
Eventually support Kirsten Dunst. Like,
yeah, I kind of thought that we were supposed to, like, really be invested in this man who has like this object of desire and then brings her into the home. And for some reason, I think, I don't know, I wasn't as seduced by their dynamic and then by the inclusion of them into the home. Like, I know it like fucks up the finances and the power dynamic and stuff like that, but even that, I had, like, it was there intuitively, but I've had to like put that to words upon reflection rather than really feeling it. Like, I don't know.
But I think it does, it kind of pulls a little bit of a trick on the audience in a way, because the sort of tension that exists between Benedict Cumberbatch and Jesse Plemons regarding his relationship with Kirsten Dunst feels like the thing that may result in some kind of conflagration. So in that way, I can kind of, like, I maybe get what's happening with those two, that they're not given a whole lot to do because it allows Cody Smith McPhee to sort of, like, swoop in at the end and be the man of action that maybe the movie is setting you up to think that Jesse Plemons is, or at least your preconceived notions of Westerns is maybe setting you up to think that Jesse Plemons might be the one to have the final say with his brother. So in that way, it's kind of sly and subversive. And I can appreciate that about it, but it still, like I said, it still just feels sort of rote. It all just kind of happens as presented. And I just don't, like I said, it's a fine movie in and of itself, but it just doesn't really leave me, I don't leave the theater thinking about it and turning over their motivations and stuff. I feel like I'm just saying the same thing over and over and over again. It's probably because I just don't find the movie all that remarkable or dense. Like we've said 1,000 times, there's a lot that's boiling under the surface for each of these characters, but it you know, they make it pretty clear what those things are. They express them pretty clearly by the end of the film. So I don't know.
I don't know if this is true or not, but I was thinking about this a little bit ago about, like, what is it that makes the poetic so creative, right? Like, and why are people drawn to poetry? And I don't just mean that in the sense of, like, the verse of actual poems, like Walt Whitman or something. But what is it about poetic, you know, the idea of poesis, making, doing, right? There's something about that word and that idea that is so powerful and potent. And what is it? And I think that part of it is that it does two things, at least, right? That it kind of, like, it forecloses and then it explodes. It explodes open. So it takes words and it puts them together in these different arrangements, and you get novel meanings. Or it takes images and it brings them together in juxtaposition or hyperbole or satire, and it brings together, and then it creates a world, and then it explodes it at the same time. And there's this constant action. And so you keep talking about the not feeling of the claustrophobia, and what I wonder is there wasn't maybe enough of a foreclosing, there wasn't enough of a clear bringing together of the tensions that then would allow for the revelations to explode. And so what you get then isn't so much of this, for people who can see a clip, if you're seeing a clip right now, my hands are like I'm like an accordion, like the in and out of like a real big in and out, like a big poetic thing would be like a real contraction and a huge explosion. This one just does like little ones. Right, just like little movements, and it doesn't really create the tension and then explode the tension and then create the foreclosure and then break open and disclosure, you know? And so maybe that's kind of what's going on. I'm just trying to kind of put my finger on what I, you know, like what's the logic here?
Like, yeah. I don't want to be too harsh about the movie or anything, because I do, like I said, I do think it's a perfectly adequate film. But I don't know. I mean, maybe I just kind of feel a little bit like Little Miss Sunshine a little. Where
is a perfectly adequate. What was the, yeah?
No. And I don't mean to, because I do think this is a better movie than that. But it just doesn't leave a lot up to the imagination, and it's not like entertaining and engaging enough in the interim for that to not be a problem.
Okay, then let's do this. Then let's do this. Like, not psychoanalyze in the deep sense, but let's like just superficially psychoanalyze why this film is getting so much attention and so much award love then. So why do you think that, why is it resonating at the level where the sort of like biggest corporate party in the world wants to reward it with attention? Is it just because people love Jane Campion and they love Westerns and they love the cat?
It's nice to see Jane Campion working on the big screen again. And I say that in all honesty. But I mean, why is it getting a bunch of awards attention? I don't know. Who cares? Like, how many fucking mediocre movies get awards attention every year? Like, we talked about this on Little Miss Sunshine. I mean, like, it's, I don't really think of the Oscars as really being a metric of what is interesting or intriguing or even the most innovative within the cinematic landscape. I mean, you ask, why is this movie getting awards attention? I mean, this to me feels like the exact type of movie that gets awards attention. It's a lovely, austere drama that's really well directed and really well acted and doesn't really challenge you in any meaningful way. It looks the way pictures ought to look. And it feels the way pictures ought to feel, and like, despite whatever, you know, fucking Sam Elliott might have to say, it's a very, very like old fashioned drama, and it feels like someone made them like they used to, and I don't know who knows why the fuck movies get nominated for awards, but this is the kind of movie that gets nominated for awards all the time. It's just perfectly average dramas that people will completely forget about as soon as the trophy is handed over. That's not, once again, not to be dismissive of it. It's once again, I think it's fine, but the notion of the Academy Awards or awards in general being some metric or you know, way of measuring any kind of success or quality of a film is just, I can't really fathom that. I don't know. The reason it's getting a bunch of awards attention is because Netflix has a ton of money to spend on campaigns and send people screeners and shit. Like,
see, that's what I think is important, because it was always, before, it was always the Weinsteins and the Rudens that would go on these huge marketing campaigns where they're manipulating votes with the power of the dollar to try to get attention, and the whole purpose is to get to drive eyeballs for distribution deals or whatever else. So my question is, like,
what's nominated, like, what, this year? Let me look them up.
Okay, because while you're doing that, yeah, let me just kind of say why another reason why I think this question is interesting is because there's something about the controlling of the narrative, right? So, like, in like political philosophy, sometimes this is called extero-conditioning, like external conditioning, right? So, like, when you see all these lists on, like, whatever the outlet is that's, like, the best 10 albums of the year, what it does is it kind of elicits this external metric.
These are the movies that can be taken seriously, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's kind of, well, like...
I mentioned why, that, like, three or four weeks ago when the...
Yeah, so there's something safe about this film, though. That's what makes... There's something safe about this film.
I mentioned this, like, a month ago, I think, on the Little Miss Sunshine episode, where I mentioned, like, how there was one anonymous Oscar voter who said something like, no, I never saw 12 Years a Slave, I just voted for it for Best Picture, because that seemed like that seemed like the movie that should win. And I think that is instructive. I don't say that to denigrate 12 Years a Slave. Like, I think that's a very good movie. But I think that is instructive in the way that these voters think about this thing is, like, you know, how many times during the fucking, like, 2020 Democratic primary did you hear, like, Biden's the safe choice? Like, Biden can get things done or whatever. Like, obviously it was a crock of shit then. It's a crock of shit now. But, like, there is, I mean, I'm looking at this list right now from this year. It's like Nightmare Alley, which I quite liked. Don't Look Up, which I wasn't crazy about, but is at least kind of transgressive. Dune, which was a big hit. Belfast is another one of those movies like this that you could just, like, see it handing it to them, because it's just like, oh yeah, that's the kind of movie that wins awards or whatever. Weepy dramas that are really, really reductive of a certain moment in time, and elide much more interesting things that are happening on the margins of the film. So it is just, I don't know. Like, this to me feels like, I'm looking at the fucking 10 movies right now. This is the one that feels the most like an Oscar Best Picture winner, whatever that means. Like, it just seems like, yeah, that'll be the one. Sure, why not? Like, I remember I was helping a friend move. This was years ago, and he had not even started looking for a new apartment the day that we were moving him out of his old apartment. And as we were driving to another friend's house where he was going to couch crash for a minute, we drove past an apartment complex that had a sign in the door, you know, for rent, one bedroom, two bedroom, blah, 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 whatever. And he goes, maybe I'll live there. And it was just one of those things, like, he could not have been bothered any less about his current situation, and, you know, more power to him. But that energy just feels like this movie is just like, yeah, sure, I guess, yeah, it'll be that. Yeah, whatever. Like, no one cares about our stupid fucking party anymore. Nobody watches this dumb fucking award show. Yeah, it'll be that one. That one looks like the one. Sure.
And it's going to be freaking huge for Netflix if they can boast. Because remember, there were a few years ago where they weren't even allowing Netflix to be in certain categories for recognition. And I think, like, films at Cannes, like, you couldn't have been, like, certain film festivals were like, this can't be a film that was made for digital streaming. It has to be a film that was made for theatrical release in cinemas. And so it was like, I think
the Sydney Film Festival
has
no such compunction, right?
Well, I mean, the Sydney Film Festival, let me tell you.
You were on the jury this year, so you could probably shed some light on the situation.
But yeah, so it does. My cynical take on this is that there are a lot of dollars that are being spent to kind of, like, boost these platforms, right? To boost these new forms of consumption. And so I wonder, right? Like, if it's a good film and it's going to last, I don't know, for 20 years in people's minds, 30 years, 50 years, if it's going to be in, like, the pantheon of cinema, that's one thing. But like, otherwise, it just makes me curious why certain films get so much narrative attention, you know? And why I open my fucking Twitter, or when I go to a news source, like, that's the film that gets talked about. And I'm always just curious. Like, I kind of want to know what's going on.
It's like the Green Book thing. I mean, do you know the story behind that? Like how that ended up being such a major Oscar player?
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Well, let's just say this real quick. Let's wrap up the episode with this, and then we can't go too much longer. But yeah, let's okay. let's yeah. end on this.
Before
let's end
I
on this positive
on a
note.
Completely pointless tangent.
Yeah.
So, Viggo Mortensen is a wonderful actor. Did a couple movies with David Cronenberg, Eastern Promises and History of Violence, two masterpieces in my personal opinion. David Cronenberg, who is a phenomenal filmmaker, one of my favorites, Canadian filmmaker. He and Viggo Mortensen went up to the Toronto International Film Festival with those pictures, and Viggo Mortensen was really big in that community at a time when TIFF was just sort of coming up in the festival circuit as sort of a major
big player.
Yeah. And so TIFF just loves Viggo Mortensen. And when Green Book came out, they were like, hey, let's open the festival with Green Book, because Viggo will come and he'll glad hand everybody. And he's kind of like a local celebrity because of his work with David Cronenberg. And everyone was just so excited to see the new Viggo Mortensen movie in Toronto because he's such a hit with that festival audience and those film writers and those locals that it just played like gangbusters. And because TIFF at that point had kind of been elevated to one of the big Oscar prognosticators, from that moment on, that like I think it won the audience award at TIFF, it was like, oh, this might be the movie. And it's shit like that. You have no fucking clue. I mean, to bring it back to 12 Years a Slave, I remember reading a review of 12 Years a Slave out of a film festival, you know, 6-8 months before it was ever going to play for a mainstream theatrical audience. And the review of it, the first line of it was literally just like, this movie is going to win Best Picture at the Oscars. That's not me saying it deserves to. That's not me saying it was the best movie I'm going to see all year. I just know for a fact that it's going to win Best Picture at the Oscars, and I just want to plant my flag on that right now. And I just remember reading that review and being like, yeah, he's probably right. Like, there's just who fucking knows how any of this shit is decided? It's all about money and what movie plays well with which audience, and which movie feels right and doesn't necessarily challenge the core audience of voters who decide on these things. And I just, to bring it back to where I started with this movie, I just don't think it's all that challenging. I think it's a movie that has all the trappings of a very deep, austere drama, but at the end of the day, you don't really have to chew on it all that much. You can leave the theater already feeling smart, and I think that's key for a lot of people who decide these stupid fucking beauty contests, to bring it back to Little Miss Sunshine.
Okay, so let's put a button on this for this episode, and let's say next week, for those of y'all that are going to tune in, we're going to talk about another film that is sure to elicit deep, deep, deep thought. We're talking about The Batman. Now, hey, I say that with a little bit of snark in my tone, but I will say that the Christopher Nolan Batman films were all really interesting with, like, the symbolism they were exploring and with the themes they were exploring. And I think that there is something interesting about why we tell the stories that we tell about ourselves. And so if we're not talking about Westerns, superhero films, I think, do have a lot of interesting archetypal and kind of conceptual stuff for us to explore. So next week we'll be talking about the new The Batman film, starring Robert Pattinson, and so, yeah. So just get prepared for that. So make sure you fucking see that shit. They should pay us royalties for advertising for our audience to go and see those films.
Not sure if people will be able to see The Batman. I think it's only playing in major cities. I think that's just a New York, LA. Maybe it'll slowly roll out to some other theaters, but you know, Robert Pattinson's kind of an indie darling, so I just don't think The Batman is on a lot of people's radars right now.
Really? But it's Batman. But it's Batman. I know. So cool.
You're
so
too good
before
of an
we get
actor.
Out of here. Before we get out of here, let me just remind you, check out our Twitter. That's SMTM_POD. I'm sorry, there's some background noise. They're fucking sawing something, and usually a saw cut is like a couple seconds, but apparently this saw cut is lasting 40 seconds. But check us out, SMTM_POD. That's SMTM_POD. Remember to email us, movies@wisecrack.co. Call us, 1213-534-8807. Raymond, where can people find you on the internet?
Actually, I want to plug something really quick. I plugged this on Culture Binge this morning as well. There's some really terrible stuff happening in Texas right now. The governor of that state is a piece of shit. So I would encourage everyone to check out the Transgender Education Network of Texas, or TENT for short. That's at TransTexas on Twitter, or check out TransTexas.org for more resources and links to donate. I've also put I retweeted a couple threads of links to resources and other organizations on the ground in Texas who are fighting the good fight to protect trans children and trans-affirming allies in that state. So you can find that, like I said, at TransTexas on Twitter, or those threads on my, what's it called, my Twitter, at Crematoria.
Sweet, sweet, sweet. And if people want to kind of track me down, it's Austin_Hayden on Twitter, AUS_HAY on Insta. I do a philosophy podcast called Owls at Dawn, and my co-host and I are philosophers by trade and by education. We are not geopolitical experts, so we haven't done a Russia and Ukraine crisis episode. However, next week we've got an international relations scholar and a philosopher by the name of Sergei Prozorov, who I've done a lot of work on. His work has informed a lot of my work. I've spent some time with him, and he's written a lot on post-communist Russia. He's currently based in Finland, where he is a professor of international relations, but we're going to have him on to kind of delve into some of the deeper complexities. I know there's a lot of confusions and a lot of speculating about certain things, so it'll be nice to get somebody who definitely has a bit more of one personal experience, yeah, since he is born a Russian national, but is also very critical and analytical about one, the Soviet Union, and then of course, as I said, post-communist Russia. So that'll be checked, that'll be up in, I guess it'll be about a week and a half, so by the time this episode's live, maybe about a week or so, but yeah, so check that goodness out. Send us out of here, Raymond.
Goodbye from, I guess, the Oscars eventually,
the
when this one racks up a bunch of trophies and we all love it.